here we are. This is Sex, Love, Psychedelics, and I'm your host, Dr. Kat, bringing you psychosexual conversations that will leave you intellectually turned on and hungry for more. Hey, lovers. Now, on social media posts, you might see pleasure as this antidote to life. And I really believe that it is, yet it truly is a concept that is not as easily accessed by everyone or even every time for us individually. What if we don't live in a location that contributes to our safety? Or what if our body has never been a place in which safety has been accessed or felt? What if we have a challenging relationship around pleasure, leading to guilt or to shame? Or what if there's just a lot of crazy shit going on in our culture and in the world, and it's leaving us all not feeling very safe to relax or even desire to feel eroticism in our body? Like, if we're not feeling sexy, because there's just a lot of shit happening, like, let's talk about it. Pleasure is something that I see clients access in ketamine-assisted therapy states, and it's powerful to witness, especially when their body has been the receiver of harm or trauma in the past. And in this episode with Courtney Watson, we talk about how psychedelics can be a powerful tool for personal exploration, both in identity, in pleasure, and in resilience. She shares about her work with the queer BIPOC, as well as practices and rituals to access inspiration from ancestral wisdom. Now, before we get to Courtney, my Sensual Awakening course is on sale right now for the holidays. This is the start to the initiation of becoming sensual in your livelihood. Learning about how to access sensuality, what may be blocking it, and how to embody choice and desire from this space of your sensual pleasure. This is a foundational program to help you to integrate pleasure into your life, learning how to downregulate your nervous system so that you can access the concept of connection and feeling really good in your body. It's a no bullshit program that cuts to the heart on how to do. So get it while it's on sale and start your new year, 2024, all about sensuality. The link is in the bio, so check it out. Now to Courtney Watson, who is a licensed psychotherapist and sex and psychedelic therapist, founder of Doorway Therapeutic Services, serving marginalized communities, particularly Black, Indigenous, people of color, queer folks, trans, gender nonconforming, non-binary, two-spirit folks, and those exploring non-traditional relationships and sex workers. I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, I first met Courtney at the Oakland Psychedelic Conference, where we were both speaking on a panel about sexual trauma and working with psychedelics. And sometimes when you're on those panels, you're limited with this time, but it just gets so juicy and you just want to keep going.
Which is why we have platforms. Like, it's nice that we have platforms like podcasts, because mm-hmm. then like people, like it opens up accessibility and like more people can engage and know about mm-hmm. the work that is out there and what folks are doing and how folks are supporting each other.
Yeah, and to really support each other in a way that, you know, not everybody can afford or is ready for therapy, and it's a way that they can get some help or inspiration. I was at a workshop last night, and the speaker said, you know, the concept of mentors doesn't just exist with a formal relationship of someone, you know, taking you under their wing, but it can be people that you talk to and listen to on podcasts or on YouTube. So I love that format.
Right. I agree.
Where I want to start with this conversation, because you speak a lot on, you know, psychedelics, but you speak a lot on sexuality and pleasure and the world right now is just, there's a lot happening in our cultural climate. And there's a lot of anger in the air. There's a lot of hesitancy and fear in the air, just from, I think, since the pandemic, it's been like that. And our nervous systems are a lot more activated than what we recognize or we may be conscious of. And it's leaving a lot of people and a lot of clients coming to me saying that they're not feeling necessarily sexy in their body or that they want to be in their bodies. And so, you know, how that impacts our eroticism or sexuality, how we show up in the world, or even our vibrancy. So I'd like to start the conversation there with what would be, from your observation, is there something important that you would want other listeners to know about their relationship, their sexuality, or how to navigate pleasure or their bodies during this time?
Yeah, I think it's interesting hearing you say it like that again, because what came up for me when you said it was there's people that have been born not feeling safe in their bodies and still have to navigate how to find access to pleasure. So the pandemic was this moment where folks that are not marginalized also got to feel some of the stuff that marginalized folks have been dealing with for their entire lives. Now, I'm not going to say that it's exactly the same, right? Because also marginalized folks also experienced the pandemic, and that was hard for all of us. So, but as you said it, I was like, yeah, for some people, 2020 was the introduction of a nervous system dysregulation. And for some people, it was a continuation or exacerbation of a nervous system dysregulation. And folks still have been able to find access to pleasure and joy and connection and eroticism. And I'm curious, I'm like thinking, like, how have people been able to do that? Particularly as someone that's descended from enslaved Africans, we can't talk about cultural trauma without talking about enslavement, without talking about the rape of Black women and men for that. Like, all Black folks were raped in that time period. And the ways that unsafety in our bodies is like has been passed down. And also, there is also resilience in the bodies. There is also access to joy. There's also access to laughter. There's also access to pleasure. And like the question that I hear you asking is like, how do folks, despite experiencing like major traumas or existing in major traumas, find ways to pleasure? And I think it's, I can't answer it wholly, but I think that at some point you still just have to feel joy. You know, at some point, you still just have to feel pleasure. There is something about resilience in the face of trauma, and different people employ different resilience strategies to be able to overcome things that are hard in their lives. But like leaning into resilience or cultivating resilience strategies that bring you back to yourself and bring you back to your body and bring you back to your pleasure, I think are the things that can help people find eroticism in climates that are really difficult, like really problematic, really traumatic.
Yeah. And what are there specific foundational tools that you give somebody? Or like, I'm thinking in my office, and I know you work with primarily marginalized populations, that, yeah, if your nervous system has a difficult time settling, like pleasure, I know helps with the resiliency of the nervous system, as in it like tones the vagus nerve. So are there particular things that you do in your practices or that you encourage people to do that help them in that regard?
One is just acknowledging that shit is hard, like permission giving to be in a puddle when things are difficult, and to know that, like, how does life exist simultaneously alongside of being in this puddle? Another thing, and I think that this is not like my personal tool, but I think it is something that like Black folks just hold as a resilience strategy, is laughter. Like, there's a cultural idiom, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's like you gotta laugh to stop crying. Keep from crying. You gotta laugh to keep from crying. right? Like, laughter is the thing, even in the worst situation. Laughter is the thing that will hold you, that kind of gives you a road out. And I've seen this a lot at like funerals. Like my aunt died in New Orleans, and it was the fucking, I have never laughed so much at a funeral in my entire life. And it was like, another aunt was down here crying. My uncle was whispering funny shit to my aunt here. That aunt was telling me something, and you could just see like pockets of people like having experiences of like deep sorrow and like deep grief, and also like trying to hold in, like bursting at the seams because we can't laugh at this funeral, like in just different parts of the church. And so I think like, yes, like knowing that even if things are hard, we still get to access joy. And if it's not something that we get to access, it's something that we have to find our way to, because joy is also a light when things are difficult. And it doesn't have to be either I'm happy or I'm sad. It can be I'm crying and I'm cracking up and I'm trying not to laugh out loud in this church, and then I'm crying again.
Yeah, yeah. So and even those two things, the crying and the laughter, are both down-regulating tools of the body to be able to ground us again. It's like after the best fucking belly laughter, I feel so chill. I'm like, oh, so good.
And sometimes people might say, well, how can we laugh in times like these? Sometimes I don't. I mean, the phrase is like, that's all you could do is laugh. That's all. This is so crazy that all I could do is laugh at this. And so, like I said, I don't think that that's a strategy that I can like say that this is a intervention that I use, but this is like what it is also to work with a clinician of color. Like, I get to bring aspects of my culture that resonate with aspects of my client's culture into a situation that's difficult, and we get to utilize that as part of the therapeutic experience too.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have your own process or practices, rituals around pleasure, or what was that relationship like for you to come into?
I don't think I ever had to come into pleasure because my mom was like really, really open. Like, I got my first Kama Sutra when I was like in high school. You know, like, and I didn't understand it because I was not, you know, like mature enough to understand what the Kama Sutra was actually about.
Yeah.
But she was like, if you have questions, then there's books, and go read some books and then come to me if you have some more questions. So there wasn't like this kind of stumbling period. And she was very much my mom told me, before you buy a shoe, you got to try it on. So it was not like, you have to wait until marriage to have sex. She was like, if and when you're ready to have sex, it should be important. It should be special for your first time. And if and when you're ready to have sex, know that you experiencing and centering your pleasure is important. And she might not have said it in those words, but that was what I really got from that, is like, yeah, like I had my first, the sex talk when I was 8. You know, and we walked around a block and she told me about sex, and I didn't understand what she was talking about at that time. I had some points of reference, but not a lot. And it was just like, yes, this is important for you to know. And then as the conversations continued, like, your pleasure. Now, she wasn't so radical that she talked about like oral sex or anything like that. Or she didn't tell me about masturbation. So I kind of found masturbation on my own.
Yeah.
But later on, we were able to talk about orgasm and the importance of experiencing sexual pleasure with a partner.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had a household that was sex positive and pleasure focused, it sounds like. Yeah. Which, bless.
Right.
Right. It saved me a lot, many years. Yeah. Yeah. That's incredible. And to, you know, yeah, to remember that, you know, the influence of our culture, including our family, sets that foundation for how we initially relate with that pleasure, relate with that family, or not.
And I think it gets to be a reparative and restorative process too, right? Like intergenerationally, like my mother was so open about sex because that was not her experience. And it wasn't that, I don't think that my grandmother's like, talked negatively about it. They talked negatively about teenage pregnancy, mm-hmm. But she was like, I just want to have a different experience and I want my kids to have a different experience. And so we did. And then me in turn, as a mother to a 9-year-old now, have also had the talk with her. And maybe I told her a little bit too much. But it's this reparative process has happened now where, like, my daughter is very clear that her pleasure is important and that you don't just have sex for procreation. But if and when you're ready, which is not now because you're 9, but if and when you're ready, like, pleasure is the point. You're supposed to people. She's like, why do people do that? That sounds disgusting. I'm like, because it feels good. That's why people do it.
Yeah, yeah. It's not necessarily practical. It feels good. Yeah.
Right. That's it. That's the reason, because it feels good. A lot of people get worried about, like, talking to kids, or is it, you know, I did it in an age appropriate way, kind of. And she's like absolutely disgusted by it. She thinks this is the worst thing ever. She puts the, she's like, it's happening, the Dungeon of Doom, the Dungeon of Doom. And then she, like, was like, okay, I'm ready to hear more. And then she would go in and out of the Dungeon of Doom until she was done with the conversation. You know, but she thinks it's disgusting and she's not at all interested in it. And that's okay, because what she knows is that if she ever is interested in it, and I'm not saying she has to be, but if she ever is interested in it, then she knows that pleasure needs to be the basis of whatever her sexual practice is going to be.
Yeah, and you've opened the door for permission to be able to come to you with questions and learn about that. How did you...
I might have opened it too wide. I told her about sex toys, and then she started finding my sex toys. And now every time she finds a sex toy, she knows what it is and what happened. And I'm like, this is why I might have gone a little bit too far.
Yeah, you know, I get asked my parents all the time how to have these conversations or create sex positive households like that. And yeah, sometimes we're gonna, we're creating that space. And then sometimes we're like, maybe that was too soon with that information. Right. But to give grace for parents rather than shame them. Right. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's gonna be something that ends up being, we're at the point where she's not going to forget that she keeps on finding these sex toys. Mm-hmm. So it's just going to be a part of, remember when I was little and I would always randomly find your sex toys? Like, it's going to be something that we can laugh about later. Yeah. Right. It's not like, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. It brings in laughter and joy into eroticism and pleasure, you know, and it sets a model for her.
Yeah.
If you want to experience sex, you can do it partnered with sex toys or not. Now, we didn't get that detailed about it, but, you know, she just knows that these are things that bring pleasure and that she, it's okay for her to access if she wants. Not mine, her own later.
Yeah. Yes. To be clear. Yeah. Yeah. And so many people don't have the family culture of this, you know, pleasure positivity, or even know what pleasure is, especially, you know, as I'm thinking, you work with queer folk and people who or trans who may not, who might not want to connect with their bodies. So you work with queer and you work with trans individuals who may not necessarily want to or feel like they can access pleasure in their body. I'm thinking particularly around body dysphoria or gender dysphoria, not wanting to even acknowledge the awareness or the presence of that and how that can impact their pleasure. How do you help them to explore pleasure or their body or even just tune into the relationship with their body to help them come into their sexual?
I think it's a very specific thing that happens for trans and gender nonconforming folks, non-binary folks as well, and maybe someone that's just queer in general. Sure. For queer folks, I have found that, like, sometimes some of, like, that negative religious upbringing or negative messages about queerness makes them disconnected from their sexuality. So it's like, me having sex is something shameful. So I do it in these hidden ways, or I do it in these ways that actually don't feel good for me. or I do it with partners that actually don't feel good for me because it's what my family says it's supposed to be, but I'm actually queer and I don't want to fuck people of the opposite gender or whatever, you know, because queer is kind of multifaceted.
Sure.
But specifically for trans folks, I think it gets to be a process of relearning, right? Like, and I think it depends on where people are in their transition, right? Understanding that if you were socialized to one in a way that did not fit well for your truth about who you are and what your body is, and there were a lot of pressures around that socialization to engage in your body in a particular way, like there needs to be healing and repair that happens with your body.
Mm-hmm.
And then also like reframing or readjusting the way that you're seeing your relationship with your body, depending on where you are in your transition. It's more than just pre-op and post-op, because I think that that's another thing too. But even early stages of transition, as you see your body start to align more with what you know your body is for you, how do we continue to be in conversation in a relationship with our body, right? Like, this is going to be an exploratory process because it never has fit for it to be what it was. How do we make it fit for what it's going to be?
Yeah.
In the way that feels good for you. And then for a lot of folks, and I think this is true for TGNC folks, and I think it's also true for people that are not TGNC, and like their assumption about like surgery is gonna solve everything. It's like, yeah. No, it can be really jarring. And so there has to be this reintroduction and integration of this new way of experiencing yourself and this new way of experiencing your sexuality. Right? Like across wherever part you are in your transition, it can be terms that you use for your body. Like what does not feel good and what really does feel good, but also terms that you use for yourself. Like how do you want your partner to acknowledge you? If you're talking dirty to your partner, what is the ways that you want this to affirm your gender in the ways that they speak about you as a sexual person and the ways that they speak about your body?
I think that's a really important point to make around empowering people to choose their own words and their own identities and their own. There's a lot of conversation around identity. And I think in on the internet, it says there's like 76 terms for gender and gender expression. And
there has to be more than that.
There might be more than that now.
There has to be more than that. 76. I mean, is that in English? That doesn't even sound culturally sound, you know?
Like,
there has to be more terms than 76. Okay.
I found it on, anyway. Sure that there's always growing. But that actually brings me to this question. Like, how do you see an identity being an important process for people in their healing and their healing process? You'll hear what I've heard is counter arguments of people who aren't marginalized, you know, say that there's too many words and too many letters in the LGBTQI and all that stuff. And so listening to that, and then also holding space for the people who do want to have these, you know, identities.
I mean, I think that this is important for my clients, regardless of what their gender and sexual orientation is. One of the things that really happens a lot with my cishet clients is permission giving, the ability to engage in their bodies and with their sexual selves in ways that fit for them is also extremely healing. I think just having permission to be who you are as a sexual person, to like what you like as a sexual person, is healing. And that cuts across gender and sexual orientation, period. Because society says sex looks like a very particular thing.
Yeah.
And that if you are queer, if you're not queer, if you are a cishet man, then sex must look like this, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also like, it's so limiting.
Mm-hmm.
So often with clients, regardless of sexual orientation, there's places that they want to explore that bring excitement to them and arousal to them. But it's like, whether it's anal, you know, butt stuff, that's one of the big things. Like, so many people want to do butt stuff, but if they feel like I can't do butt stuff because butt stuff is only for these people or butt stuff means this, mm-hmm. and just, or have had partners that have shamed them for that desire to do mm-hmm. that stuff. And so just being like, no, actually, yeah, you can do that. And let's talk about how you two need to talk about this so it works for your relationship and what you're engaging in sexually. And so coming back to the question, I think it's just permission to own fully your sexuality, period, for mm-hmm. everyone. What yeah. is it that I like? What is this thing that I always wanted to do? What is this thing that I always wanted to try? How can I experience that? And how can that be okay? And if it's mm-hmm. not okay with this person that I'm with, how can I find the right person that is okay to do it with? Because mm-hmm. I don't need to be with this person here.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, as I'm listening to you talk, it's also kind of like creates a sense of safety when other people can identify and validate, you know, that they have a similar experience too. Because when demisexual or asexual, you know, started becoming something that was more talked about, more people were like, oh, it's okay for me to not feel sexual or not want sex, but still enjoy pleasure or kissing my partner, or, oh, it's okay if I'm only sexually desiring somebody in this context, but not in this context. And so how much we can feel more fear of exclusion or rejection when we're the only person who is feeling a certain way.
I think that is something that so many labels helps with. It helps people to be like, oh, I'm not the only one. You know, one journey that I can tell you about is my journey to queerness. And I didn't identify as queer for so long because I thought it had to look like something that was prescribed to me. Mm. Right? Or I use the term queer over bisexual. I really don't identify with the term bisexual, because when I think of bisexual, I think of like spring break, like MTV spring break, like being drunk and like tongue kissing in a triangle. And that just did not fit for me. And when I found the term androphile, I was like, oh, okay, here we are. This is what makes sense to me. Right. And so when people ask me about my queerness, what I'll say is I'm attracted to masculinity, regardless of the genitals that are attached, right? Masculine energy, regardless of the genitals that are attached. And there could be some play or some interest in like femme or femininity, but like there's this fluidity that I did not see described to me when I heard the term bisexual. So I do think it's really important for folks to have access to terms just to open up this knowledge that you're not the only one, or it's more than what we are told or prescribed or proscribed on TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which can also really block our internal exploration too. I had clients who, I've seen this multiple times, where there was a part of them that felt disconnected from their body and sad, but they couldn't connect to why until they started meeting people who were non-binary or trans. But then there was still a block inside of them that prevented them from going into the space of questioning that. And it was actually with psychedelic therapy or ketamine assisted therapy that allowed them to be able to look at that more in a safer space.
Right.
What is that you work with psychedelics?
With ketamine, yeah.
With ketamine, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Have you seen similar? What does that look like for in your office?
Yeah, 100%. I've had clients, not just one, but multiple clients that have had this coming out. Around like, oh, now this thing is that's always been there. I can like give voice to it, or I can acknowledge it and it can feel safe. Yeah, I think psychedelics, but I also think psychedelics kind of help you blur the lines, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And find yourself in the blurriness, because I don't think that anyone is necessarily staunchly in any category. Mm-hmm. This is my personal opinion. I'm in a very queer community, and so it might just be my lens and my bubble. And I'm also in the Bay Area, so it might just be my lens and my bubble, but I have not found that. So I'm just like, this is what it is, and it's staunchly this, and it has to, you know, I'm like, it's always kind of blurry. There's always an exception. So I found that when we're doing CAP work, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, people find themselves in, not just sexually or gender-wise, but find all so many aspects of themselves in these blurred lines and are able to like acknowledge that, take that in, bring that with them at the end of the journey. And then we'll get to work with that.
I see the same thing with, you know, the intersection of sex and psychedelics too, because I see psychedelics really helping us to redefine what sex is, similar to what you were saying a moment ago. Like we've been conditioned that it's genital focus, it's orgasm focus, it's focus on the other person. It has to do with just with our bodies and friction. And yet there can be this energetic experience that I've seen, especially clients like my trans clients, realize that they can experience orgasm in an energetic state that didn't have to involve their genitals. And so that made it a lot safer for them to access sex.
What I have also, in speaking of this energetic sex, is people find that they do have the genitals that are aligned with them, but they're just energetically there. And so like it can be someone that is like a masculine woman, and she's engaging in energetic sex and she's like, here's my dick, you know? So there's also like, and I love energetic sex and eroticism and play. I think it's something that is completely missed, but I think that's because it kind of has the spiritual bit too, like, you know, people feel like, oh, you kind of out there if you're talking about energetic sex is very much of a real thing. Probably some of the stuff that was in the Kama Sutra that I didn't understand when I was in high school, now I'm starting to understand, you know. But there's so much that you can explore. And I've been talking with some of my clients, some of my sex therapy clients, about sex being more than just, definitely more than PMV, but more than the physical. And what is the energetic exchange that happens between the two of you when you're engaging in? And when does that start? When does it end? How do you keep it going so it's not just an all-day thing like simmering, but it's something that can be taking place over the weekend, you know?
Yeah. In some of the work that I've seen you speak on, including the panel that we talked about, you address the importance of supporting clients and connecting with their ancestors, connecting with ancestral resilience as a tool to be able to help them heal or even just find their inner strength. What does that look like in your practice or with the psychedelics? What have you seen in those spaces or even for yourself?
I think it depends on the person. But one thing that I can say is through working with ancestors in terms of sexuality, there's definitely the space of healing sexual trauma through sexual pleasure. Like if we give our bodies permission to engage in sexual joy and pleasure eroticism, we also give our ancestors who were harmed permission to open up that aspect through us as well, you know? And this, you know, different lineages or traditions have different beliefs about ancestors, but in some of the lineages and traditions that I study under, we are them, right? Like their DNA is in us. I inside of my body is everybody that ever came before me. And so through me, they get to experience healing. And that goes back and that goes forward. So like situation with my mom, where all of a sudden she was sexually open, she healed things for our ancestors in the past. And that also impacted me and it impacted my daughter in a very real tangible way that we can see now. And so, I mean, to me, this would kind of involve like maybe more specific questions so I could see exactly how what that would look like, because there's so much opportunities, there's so much possibility for ancestral healing through sexuality, because there's so many facets of sexual harm, but there's also so many facets of sexual joy and pleasure that we get to explore as well.
Yeah, I've had clients do their own research after some of our sessions where they're like, oh, I didn't think about connecting with my Persian lineage to discover, you know, some of the you know, ancient goddesses of fertility and, you know, and connecting with that, even though there's a whole lineage of trauma, sexual trauma in my, you know, on my maternal side. And that was really powerful for her to be able to tap into that, you know, the symbol of that, but also, you know, embody that strength and what that represented for her.
But also the way that sex, joy, and pleasure were okay or normalized, like in ancient, you know, times, right? It's like, this is another thing about the way that ancestral connection can heal us. Like, you gave this example of a Persian client connecting with fertility goddesses, but what about the ways that sexuality was normalized in society? I think about, not necessarily Persian, I think of more about like the Greeks, and it was like the idea that like actually sex workers were like necessary for mm-hmm. like the sanity of the community. Like, you needed to have a place where you can go. Or sex workers were sacred because they were also like priestesses of these goddesses, or there were sacred sex rituals that were occurring. Like, and then one of the things that there was a moment for me in West Africa, there is certain ethnic groups that have what they call secret societies, which is really just indigenous practices. They're not secret societies. They're not cults. They're just the indigenous practices of the people there. But they have to keep it secret because of colonization and criminalization and demonization and all these things.
Sure.
But there's a, and I'll get you the name because I haven't looked at this in a while, but they had like these sex schools where like people would go and learn from, they would have a professional that would come and teach them about sex.
Wow.
So like, if you were going to get married, like this is what you needed to know, but it was focused on sexual pleasure, mm-hmm. like not procreation. And then recently I read an article about, it was in, I don't know if it's in West Africa. It's definitely in the top half of Africa. Might've been Central Africa, but there's a community or ethnic group where the auntie will go and have sex with the groom mm-hmm. to make sure that he was actually going to be offering a pleasurable experience to the bride. And mm-hmm. if he didn't, then she would teach him what he needed to know in order for him to offer a pleasurable experience to the bride. And it's like, yeah, yes. Yes. Where is that? And also, can I be that auntie? Like, I'm down for this job. And it's like, very normal. It's not something that is bad or crazy or incestuous. I mean, it's not his aunt, it's her aunt. It's not something bad or crazy or incestuous. And it just normalizes that sexual pleasure is an important part of being in a relationship. It's an important part. It is like the fact that someone is sexually fulfilled, not moving out of the individualistic mindset, is not just a benefit to that person, but it's a benefit to our whole family.
Yeah.
It's a benefit to our whole community. And so getting knowledge like that, we're like, that's what my people did. How do I get back to that shit? Or if I'm not all the way to get back to that, how do I let go of the shame that I have for whatever I'm doing? If that's something that pre-colonization, pre-contact with Europeans, pre-oppression, that was our normal, you know? So mm-hmm. I think that those are also the ways that tapping into ancestors can offer healing and expand and blow open sexual pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's so, gives me shivers. That's so good. I listened to a podcast one time where somebody was talking about, you know, encouraging everyone to do ancestral work, as in go back through your lineage, as in today many of us are disconnected from ritual, or we're disconnected from, you know, tapping into the beauty of everything that's around us, or the spirituality of things, and going back into your lineage to see where in your family history there you might hold shame for the patterns of the family or that culture, and then even see even further if there's, you know, ritual, spirituality, sexuality in that frame. And I went back through mine and it was a lot of, you know, Catholicism and then going into the Druids and going into, so that it, what I had to go pretty far back to find, and I had to do a lot of work around the shame around, you know, what I had held with my, Catholicism at the time too. Now I don't have the same stickiness in my body that I did. But what is that? Have you gone through a similar process for yourself, or have there been rituals or practices you did to connect with your roots, your guides, your...
I don't know about sexually, because like I said, I didn't necessarily feel like I had something that I needed to overcome.
Yeah.
But speaking of Catholicism, one of my favorite, I was raised Catholic. And I went to Catholic school for 16 years, pre-K through college.
Same.
And my great grandmother really wanted me to be a nun. Like, she really, really wanted me to be a nun. And I think I was in high school and I learned that, like, women would become nuns because they, well, not at, across the board, right? But, like, people would find safety for their queerness in being a nun because they wouldn't have to get married. And then you get to live in a convent with a bunch of ladies, you know, and there might be other queer ladies in the convent. And so it's like nunnery might have been a vehicle for people to be their full queer self.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know this. Where did you find this?
I remember that has stuck with me from the times of high school. I don't remember, but I'm pretty sure you can look it up. And there's also stories of like when you'll hear stories of like some of the saints that became nuns, like I definitely know that there are some female saints that became nuns because they didn't want to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the fact that, like, if you really look at Catholicism back in the day, like, abortions were okay.
Yeah.
The place where they decided that where abortions, the line was different, or that priests sanctioned abortions for people, you know. So it's all about cultural context. The religion at this point is really about where you are at this place, time and now, and what is the social norms this place, time and now, because religion is a living thing that shifts and changes. So that was, I mean, I don't think my great grandma knew that when she was telling me to be human. And I think that can be healing for folks that do struggle with Catholic guilt. You know, that can be healing to say that, oh, actually, there was this space of openness where there was, if someone is a queer Catholic, you know, there was a way that folks found to be able to be their full queer selves. I know a lot of gay priests. I'm like, you're gay. Okay. And, you know, how much of the priesthood is the way that folks, and I'm not saying this across the board, but
sure,
is one of the ways that folks can reckon with their religion and their sexual orientation.
Yeah. 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 Wow. That's such an interesting perspective to, you know, reveal there. I always think, you know, now I have a lot of gratitude for my Catholic upbringing because now sex can be very kinky for me. There's the taboo aspect, the guilt aspect that it still gives me some titillation to do things that's quote unquote naughty, you know, and so I'm like, great.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, this was a great conversation, Courtney. I'm really happy that you came on. How can people find you?
So I am on Instagram, but it's been kind of dead lately. The best way to find me is my website. I'm very responsive, and a lot of people are kind of shocked how responsive I am. If you email me, I will email you back. And if you're like, let's connect and I want to learn more about you, I'll be like, okay, you know, we'll set up some time and we'll talk. Like, I'm very accessible. And so I think connecting with me through my website and reaching out if you're interested in talking about something or exploring something. And it doesn't have to be a therapeutic relationship. Like, I love working with students. A lot of students will be like, I just want to pick your brain.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I'll do. I'll talk to students. So I do a lot of lectures at a lot of different places on sex or psychedelics, sometimes both. But also, like, student groups will have me out to talk about something, and I do that as well. So
yeah,
if you want to connect with me, just reach out.
Great. We'll include the links in the show notes, and that's a wrap. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was fun. Thanks for tuning in, lovers. And if you want to experience more ecstasy and sexual liberation, head over to sexlovepsychedelics.com and learn about how you can join me for any one of my online or live events. And while you're there, grab my free guide on sex and psychedelics. Remember, this podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Please contact your healthcare provider and local law before pursuing any of the products or psychedelics discussed. And one final note here. I make this show specifically for you. If you're loving the show, then be sure to leave me a review in iTunes or Spotify to let me know. Happy to be here and happy to serve. I'll see you next time on Sex, Love, Psychedelics.